Hi, everyone. Welcome to The Psychology of Work, Why People Do What They Do, a podcast exploring the science and stories behind high-cohesion, high-performing teams. My name is Dr. Bobbi Wegner. I'm a lecturer at Harvard in organizational psychology and the founder of Groups. In each episode, we dive into the minds of industry experts to uncover what drives team and individual dynamics, tackle real-world challenges together, and share actionable insights to help teams feel and function their best. Thanks so much for joining, and let's get started. Welcome back, everyone. I'm so excited to be here today on The Psychology of Work with Sebastian Page. So Sebastian is a chief investment officer and head of global multi-asset at T. Rowe Price, where he leads investment strategy in equities, fixed income, and alternatives for over $500 billion in assets. But his real passion is talking about the psychology of leadership. Alongside his work in investing, he studies leadership through the lens of personality, performance psychology, and decision-making under pressure. His latest book is called The Psychology of Leadership, which explores how leaders think, react, and show up, especially when stakes are high and the answers are not clear. So I'm just getting to know Sebastian now, and I just cannot wait to have this conversation and take a deeper dive. But Sebastian, who are you? What's your story here? Why'd you write this book? What's your book about? Give us a bit of a snapshot, if you will.
Oh my. First of all, I'm excited too. I've been listening to prior episodes of your podcast, and I absolutely love how you bring positive psychology to the workplace. That is the whole point of the psychology of leadership. So I've been looking forward to that discussion. But you're starting hard here. Who are you? That is actually a very tough question.
My gosh, do you want to lie down on the couch? This is like starting off with the biggest existential question there is.
So I'll tell you about me. I've been in the rough and tumble world of money management for 25 years. I still am. It's been an exciting, at times stressful career. At some point, 5-6 years ago, I got really interested in sports psychology and positive psychology. That led to my research nerd mentality from my background doing research in quantitative economics and finance to move towards research in psychology from the perspective of the positive side and high performance and resilience and relationships in the workplace and organizations. Everything you talk about, Bobbi. So I came from business into psychology, and I know we were just chatting about how you came from psychology and moved into business. And here we are operating around the same concepts. But that book for me has been so much fun to write. It's been quite successful. Top 10 leadership books of 2025. It's been a great launch. I've been able to thrive in my day job at the same time. And so I'm not going to become a full-time author here, but the book is doing great and I'm doing podcasts to talk about it. And so here we are.
I love it. Yeah, it's that's the way it works, right? It's like I always say psychology is not rocket science, but it is like once you see it and understand it, it's like seeing the matrix. And once you can see it, gives you levers to operate on. So people think of psychology as sort of like soft or something, you know? And I'm like, this is actually, it takes all the weirdness out of dynamics and things people feel and gives you words to these things that we feel, then we can actually solve for and optimize for. But what are some of the basic principles of the book? Like, tell us a bit about the book. What did you find? You have had a long career and you also have done the research around this. So what are some of the things that you've noticed?
It's so fascinating. What makes people happy is what we see every day, and we don't realize it. We tend to define our happiness as a future state on things that aren't actually related to the science of happiness. That was number one. You look at survey data, Bobbi, 80% of young people, when they're asked what their long-term goal is, they want to become rich. 50% want to become famous. That's perfectly fine, by the way. It's okay. And it's great. It's exciting. But the science, the psychology behind it is that it's not about these things whatsoever. So what will make people thrive? What will make people happy? Turns out there's decades of research on this. Again, I'm a finance nerd, so I was discovering all of this. And then thinking about my own perspective and how I can bring that to the workplace, to team dynamics, to high performance. That became a huge part of the book. And then I get into execution. You know, leaders have to set long-term goals, but they also have to bring people along. And lastly, I got to say, probably the most fun part to write, personality psychology. Because if you want to bring people along, you need to build empathy, understanding how they're wired. Tons of research on that too. I tried to take the research, apply it to my own career, my own experience, use stories and anecdotes, and then add some humor around it, make it easy to read. And then it all hangs together around this idea that you're working on, which is bringing positive psychology to leadership and the workplace.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love it. And when you think about personality, like say more there. So I ask that because right now we've built out assessments. So there's this idea from a clinical lens, when you're teaching psychologists how to be a psychologist, the first thing you teach is self, other, space in between. Who are you? And this idea of you or this concept is, it's like what our reality is. There's my favorite quote is, where you think you stand determines what you think you see. There's no true absolute. It's just the lens in which I see the world based on how I was raised, my parents, where in the world I grew up, how people treated me, all those things. And now you put all these people in a workplace with all these different experiences. That's kind of the self part or who. So there's self, other, which would be you or whoever else the person is in the dynamic, and then the space in between. So as a psychologist, you're always analyzing, what am I bringing? What's getting triggered in me in this moment based on all these factors? What do I think is going on with you? And then how are we intersecting or interacting to either support the goals that we've articulated, business goals in that realm, right? Marriage goals in that realm, like whatever it is. And then you're kind of measuring against that. So personality is a huge driver of the way that interaction goes. But what did you find in your research, or what jumped out to you?
Well, I love how you frame it. And that's why I love personality psychology, because you learn about yourself, the self. You learn about others. And in doing so, you improve your interactions with others. Now, Bobby, before I get into personality psychology, again, I'm a nerd. I've been reading the research. I wrote about it. There are tons of disclaimers around this. First of all, there's an academic debate that I'm sure you're aware of as to whether your personality is part of your DNA, ingrained, inherited, or whether your personality can change based on the situation. There's also a debate as to, can you actually evolve and hack your own personality?
Yeah.
So where I land, and I'd love to know where you land, but the data shows it's maybe 30% or 35% heritable. So you will get some of it from your parents, but a huge part of it is developed, is environmental, is habits, is who you hang out with. And that's super interesting. If I can improve and evolve my personality, why wouldn't I? But for me, again, I'm starting as a business person. I'm learning this. This is natural for you and for psychologists. And I just became so fascinated. Everybody knows if they're an introvert or an extrovert. We've brought that concept, extroversion, to the business place. There are famous books about it. But the rest of the big five traits in personality are equally, if not more, interesting. Talking about conscientiousness, talking about openness to experience, talking about neuroticism, and so on. So I look at all these traits, and I think about how people work together in the workplace, and I conclude we can all benefit from building the empathy of understanding people's wiring around these different traits. Practical tip, if you're at work and you have an important project to do, and you understand that on your team, some people are very conscientious, others less so, I will advise you not to give the project only to a team comprised of only hyper-conscientious people. Because you know what? It'll slow down. People will try to do it perfectly. Look, conscientiousness is a good trait to have. It's valued in the workplace. Mm-hmm. But people who might be more free-willing, more innovative, willing to do 80-20 solutions, put them in the team too. Balance the team out. And then you'll see wonderful results from those frictions, from those tensions. This is just one example of, it's like you put x-ray glasses and you see through the dynamics. All that, Bobby, and I'm going to stop here, all that in the context of those caveats, right? Those caveats that you can't explain 100% of people's behavior with personality traits, right? You want to understand how they're wired broadly, but you don't want to say, oh, of course, they're an extrovert. Oh, yeah, they're going to talk ad nauseum in meetings. Oh, of course, they'll do that. They're, you know, a hyper-conscientious person. It's not a good thing to stereotype based on this. But then once you accept those limitations and you use the tools within those boundaries, there's just so much team building, putting teams together, empathy, communication, to your point, the self, others, and interaction. All of this can benefit from the knowledge of personality psychology. And you know what? It's a lot of fun to learn about this because you can then learn about yourself.
Mm-hmm.
You can go online and take some tests and see where you score. In the book, I took a risk. I went online, I took the test, and I actually published all my results in the book.
Oh, amazing. Wait, what are you? Do you remember? Did you take the 16 characters? It's the MBTI.
I took the big five. This is actually a good question because there are many, many models of personality that are used in business in some cases.
100%.
The popularity of personality science goes up and down in business. I think it's underrated generally. But the one that's mostly used in academia is the big five. So when you start reading actual experimental research, it's usually the so-called big five. Openness, conscientiousness, extroversion, agreeableness, neuroticism. So that's the one I took. Now, if you want me to be really open, I'll tell you where I am.
I mean, I'm like way always comfortable with openness. So no pressure either if you don't want to do that.
Well, maybe, Bobby, you'll have to give us your...
I can't remember this one. I'll tell you my MBTI. I was like, what are my big five? My MBTI, I'm an ENFJ. So it's... That makes sense for me. You know, I like structure. I like predictability. I'm extroverted. I like to plan. I feel through doing. I learn through doing by like being active. These things I don't actually find super private. Like that for me, I think my comfort with this kind of stuff is higher than the average person. But we're having these debates as we're building out the platform side of our company within, I was telling you earlier, within Harvard's like AI Foundry. And we're having a lot of internal debates around like, disclosure and privacy. And like, do people want to share these things or do you get kind of boxed in?
Yeah.
If the team, if the culture values certain personalities like extroversion and you are an introvert, do you really want your whole team knowing that? Or is there value in actually sharing that? Because like divergence, diversity on team drives outcomes. We know that's like a part of a high cohesion, high performing team. But so there's a balance there, right?
Once you have those extra glasses,
you're
kind of going to be able to read people better. And I don't think people should be forced to take tests and disclose their tests and wear them on a card and on their shirt. I actually think it's perfectly fine to be private about this. But let me walk you. I won't be. So on openness, I scored high. It turns out it's one of the top three traits that are positively correlated with leadership success. So openness to experience, meaning I like to try new things.
I'm definitely high on that. I'm like dive in head first to everything. Yeah.
So there you go. We'll see if we're the same on each of them. But on openness, I scored fairly high. It's good for leaders because it means you're open to innovation. You tend to look around the corner. And it's openness to experience in most of the research, but I like to redefine it even more broadly as openness to ideas. And that's a good quality to have as a leader. Conscientiousness, it's sometimes perceived as a super trait because if you're conscientious, you're organized, your desk is clean, you're on time, you're probably an A student.
Mm-hmm.
The downside of it is, you're also probably prone to burnout and perfectionism.
And like rigidity, potentially.
Rigidity. inability to improvise. But I scored high on conscientiousness. It's the second of the three traits that are positively correlated with leadership success. By the way, those correlations aren't that high, like 30, 40%.
Yeah.
But conscientiousness, I scored high. Where would you put yourself, Bobby?
I would be, so within the MBTI model, I'm a J, which means I'm predictable, or I like structure. I'm a very open person, but I also like to be on time. I like people to do what they say they're going to do. I like lists and checking them off, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But I think I would actually score, probably wouldn't be my top score. Openness would be super high. Conscientiousness would be probably mid high, but not the highest.
Yeah. Now we get to extroversion. In the book, The Psychology of Leadership, I have a story about my first sales trip with a salesman who had the highest extroversion score you can imagine.
Yeah.
I call him the human piranha on steroids. You'll have to get the book to read the story because it's too long for the podcast. But it's interesting because some people you'll see, okay, they're an extrovert. Like there's no doubt about it. I'm on the introversion side. So for me, it's a little draining to meet new people, to go to cocktail parties. My energy will go down. If you're an extrovert, this is a really good test to understand. Yeah. And you go to meet new people or go to a cocktail party or you're in a social situation, your energy level goes up, then you're more likely an extrovert. Again, I can be an extrovert in some situations.
But that's like context drives these things too. Although some of these things are stable, right? Like given your role, like you have to be social and out. But so like it can skew people a bit because you have to be, but there's a cost to it. So if you know you're more introverted and your role requires you to be extroverted, it doesn't mean you can't do it. It just means you're going to pay the price in some way. You're going to have to come home and detox from things, I imagine, for like 2 days or something after. I'm definitely extroverted. Like I like going to a random party, meeting strangers and going deep and just like doing all that. And like I travel a fair amount for work. I give talks, that kind of thing. But when I come home, like we have a little beach house like an hour away. I love going down there by myself and just like reading, being near the water, going for long walks, chilling and not talking to anybody. It's like I think I'm definitely extroverted and I also need time when I go really hard to just like disappear too for a bit, totally by myself.
Yeah, there's no doubt I lean introvert. And by the way, extroversion is positively correlated with leadership success. It's more positively correlated with getting the promotion versus leadership effectiveness.
Totally.
There's a lot of power that introverts have in terms of their ability to prepare, to do independent work. They're actually a much better listener, which is for high-level leadership. It's not about talking. It's not about you. It's about your listening ability. And so leadership effectiveness in role, if you can be mindful enough to promote introverts, you'll see they have incredible effectiveness.
Wait, did you read the book Quiet before we jump
onto that?
That's a great book. And it's kind of like the cultural misnomer around introversion and why introverts are such a superpower, but like historically undervalued in organizations, which is just not right.
Yeah. And by the way, again, you don't want to stereotype, right? It's not like extroverts are all jerks that like to hear themselves talk and introverts are all underrated in the workplace. But these are tendencies that once you have these X-ray glasses on, you see them. And that helps manage teams. The next trait, I'm curious where you're going to rank yourself, Bobby, in high or low, is agreeableness. Now, I got to say, like, this is why you need to go online and take a test because everybody thinks they're agreeable. Yeah. I thought I was agreeable. And I ranked disagreeable. And I found that fascinating. And those tests, you kind of know how you're going to rank by how you answer. That's not the interesting part. The interesting part is that 10,000 people answered the same questions. So how did you rank yourself relative to the 10,000 other people that answered those questions? That's where it gets interesting, right? So on that scale, I ranked as disagreeable. If you're agreeable, it can be like a people pleaser.
Like, how do you operationalize this?
Yeah, you have a hard time pushing back, right? Can be a yes person. If you're disagreeable and you're in academia partly as part of your many hats that you wear, you know, in academic circles, people tend to be more disagreeable because that's kind of how you push knowledge, is by playing devil's advocate with each other and disagreeing on ideas, because then you push your thinking further and you actually discover things through that friction. And disagreeableness is quite important in money management because no one knows the future. And we therefore need to have our ideas clash about what we expect is going to happen. So it's not just an unpleasant thing to do. If you do it well, being disagreeable can be quite productive. Mm-hmm. So anyways, I had to take another test because I thought, whoa, I'm not that disagreeable. Then I had to talk to my wife, who's like an outlier on the agreeable side, like a people pleaser.
Like super nice. Okay.
And of course she said, oh, no, you're not disagreeable because she's so agreeable. And I disagreed with my result that I'm disagreeable. There's a little bit of a paradox there, but where would you put yourself, Bobby?
Yeah, I have so many thoughts about this. I think I'm actually more disagreeable, but I think there's like a societal thing too that I see this in teams all the time. People think of conflict as bad, right? But we know in a high cohesion, high performing team, it's a driver of outcomes. So in my mind, I see is disagreeing or conflict as a sense of like trust. Like, I trust you're not going to judge me or if I'm disagreeing with you. And so I see it as a positive thing. So it gives me the freedom to be able to disagree. So I'm comfortable with that because that's how I think about it. But I think on a cultural level, we've been taught to be nice, be polite, let people go first. Agree. Da, da, da. So there's like a bit of a norm that we have to fight against. But because I think I'm in this field, I've defined it differently in my mind. And in like the team's work, it's like if there's a team that's disagreeing, that's like a innovative team.
Yes.
They're pushing ideas. And there's high psychological safety. They're willing to take risk and put and like not be in alignment with each other at times.
This can be difficult.
Yeah.
It can be difficult to disagree on ideas because when our IQ is involved, when the intellect is involved, sometimes I've noticed the EQ shrinks a little bit. And if someone says, I think you're wrong because XYZ, especially if it's a mathematical problem, for example, then we tend to take it personally. In my team, we always talk about the fact that your idea is not you. And if you have a cherished idea, you should put it on the chopping block. If it survives, you're going to feel even more confident in it. And if it doesn't, then it wasn't that good an idea to begin with. But all of this, Bobby, is really hard to do, and it can be unpleasant. Mm-hmm. You talk about psychological safety. I talk about the ingredients that you need to make this work. And they're number one, trust.
Yeah.
You know, don't BS, don't lie just for the sake of argument, because then you erode trust and then it's not going to work. And number two, super important, mutual respect.
Yeah.
And this is why I work from home and Zoom and all that stuff. Maybe I sound too dismissive of it when I say all that stuff, but this is one of the drawbacks. There are advantages to not having a commute. But when you're in person, you can send body language signals that don't go through a camera that basically say, I respect you. I just disagree with what you just said. And the subtlety of that happens much better in person. So trust and mutual respect. Get to know people as people.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not talking about building personal relationships with everybody at work and, you know, hanging out together all the time outside of work. That's probably unhealthy. Mm-hmm. But just have conversations where you learn about people, who they are, what's their hobbies, their family. And they're not just someone who's disagreeing with you. They're a real person. You trust them and there's mutual respect. Then it's going to work. Then you're going to build a high-performing team. Mm-hmm. In the book, in The Psychology of Leadership, I talk about agreeableness. And of course, it's nice to be agreeable. And some leaders in some cultures that I've seen push the requirement to be agreeable to an extreme that is counterproductive. They try to build consensus.
Oh, yeah.
And if people disagree and there's one good path to take for the business, there's a right direction and a wrong direction. If you're a leader who just prizes agreeableness and you're wired as super agreeable, you're going to spend so much energy trying mm-hmm. to build the consensus rather than just disagree and commit, make the decision. Mm-hmm. It's exhausting trying to build consensus all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's good to be agreeable, and some leaders err on the other side and they're just complete jerks and disagreeable for the sport of it, or they don't have self-control mm-hmm. and they let their ego get in the way and they'll disagree with you just because they don't like that you sound smarter than them and so on. So my conclusion in the book, there's a lot of science and research in the book, but this is me. This is a made up conclusion, okay? I'm saying it.
Yeah, go say it.
My conclusion is that a good leader should be disagreeable about 10% of the time.
Okay.
Not research backed, experience backed.
Yeah, you're just, but that's valid, right? It's like clinical intuition is what we'd say in the psych world, right? But it's like you've lived it. So 10% disagreeable, only 10%?
Yeah.
I would say even higher. Or I think a lot of it could be, or this could be a whole debate. Is like, is it role dependent? Because at times we talk a lot of, so I teach groups and culture. It's the Teams class I was telling you about. And we know everything I look at is through high cohesion. How do you build high cohesion environments? Because those are that's the thing that drives outcomes. It doesn't matter if it's in the health world or it's in the business world. It's like the cohesion of the team. And then under cohesion, there's all these different variables that go into it, right?
Yeah.
So one thing we know is like getting people to kind of come along or co-create or feel part of something is going to help drive cohesion in a team. And teams, business is not a democracy either, right? There's decisions that have to be made. There's time pressures, there's responsibilities. And if I'm being honest, I struggle with this like in our own company. Because I'd like to have consensus, but at times I'm like, we just got to go here.
Yep.
And like, we're not going to agree and we're not at consensus, but we got to be able to like move forward. And personally, it's not comfortable for me, but I feel like it's just part of the gig when you're in this role, if I'm the CEO, like it just is what it is. But 10% seems low.
Yes.
Or maybe I'm being too disagreeable. I don't know.
No, it's great. It's awesome. One thing you brought up that I really like, which is role dependent.
Yeah.
So in our business, we have product managers. The role is to connect the investors with the salespeople, with the business strategy people, to develop and manage products. Mm-hmm. You can imagine how we have all these product ideas, these new strategies, but we can only choose and develop two or three.
Yeah.
So if you're a product manager, actually your job description is almost consensus builder. And there it's more agreeableness oriented.
Mm-hmm.
If you're a CEO, yes, you're going to have to put your foot down. And here's how I arrive at 10%. If you have a high functioning team, you shouldn't have to put your foot down all the time.
Yeah. Interesting. That could be a signal that if you're always
you're ineffective,
not aligned, something's not right.
If the team's working well, two of your top leaders should be able to disagree and come to a conclusion without your involvement. If you're always, always settling debates in your team constantly, there's something wrong with the effectiveness of how peer-to-peer relationships are happening. So if you're always, I have this example in the book about the show Game of Thrones, right?
Yeah.
The most hated character in the history of TV is the young king, Joffrey Baratheon.
Okay.
He's horrible. He's mean. Right. He's cruel. He's just like 100% disagreeable for the sport of it and so on. And there's a scene where he's a relatively new king and the family's there around the table and his brother is being disagreeable with Joffrey, the new king. The brother is older, and he goes, I don't think we should do that. And Joffrey gets super, super angry. He pounds the table and he goes, "I am the king and I will punish you." And the wise grandfathers of the Lannister family. Now, sorry, I'm geeking out on the show, but there's a point I'm making here. The wise grandfather looks at Joffrey, the new king, and says, "Any man who needs to say, 'I am the king,' is no true king."
Totally.
So if you always have to exert your authority and be disagreeable as a leader, you're missing something. You're not leading by example. You're not inspiring people to act.
I would say it's low cohesion. The team's not operating.
Exactly. Well, better said than I could have ever said it. That's exactly how.
There's this image I learned when I was learning more about group psychology, and it's true. So part of what we're talking about, and we could have a whole other podcast on this, is like there's the individual leaders, but then there's the team developing in relation to. So teams go through their own stages of development. Yep. And so when you're building a team, or even if it's a psychotherapy group or it's your kids' baseball, it doesn't matter. Like whatever group you're bringing together, the goal is to build cohesion to drive outcomes. But at the beginning of like team development, the more is required of the leader. So you're inserting yourself more, you're creating structure. Humans have two needs, right? They want to feel in control. They want to feel like they belong. And so the leader very early has to send signals. You belong here. I know what I'm doing. I'm going to create some structure. We're going to create some norms so we understand what's going. And then over time, the team starts to gel, right? Team builds the cohesion. And then as that happens, the leader, less is required of the leader. The team sort of like working versus the leader like pulling the team along. But when that doesn't happen, that's a sign of a low cohesion team or a leader who's over-inserting themselves. So something's not right there. And I think that's really what you're talking about.
Exactly. And the top leaders I've seen where they build cohesive teams, to use your term, really had to intervene. Again, I go back to that 10%. And there are times where you have to step in and disagree and put your foot down. I work in very highly professional, polished circles. Yeah. I wear a suit every day. Some of the top leaders, most inspiring leaders I've seen, just very composed. But you know what? I would see them like once in a while when things get heated, there's a decision to be made. That's the 10%.
Yeah.
They come in and they'll even like drop a swear word.
Yeah.
And you haven't heard them swear ever.
Yeah.
Every 6 months.
Well, it's probably strategic, right? They're not losing it. It's strategy.
Yeah. And that's the 10%.
Yeah.
Once in a while, you're not going to be a leader if you can't solve really hard issues for the team.
Yeah.
But ideally, you're going to minimize that over time. I'm not telling everybody to start swearing, by the way.
Oh, yeah. And I'm going to start dropping F-bombs in my next meeting. And I'll be like, "Sebastian told me to."
Yeah. No, but it's just an example of there are these moments that require any leader to be forceful, put their foot down. That's unavoidable.
Well, I think you're setting the boundaries. Like, I think there's a difference between dysregulation and swearing because you're out of control. And then also like communicating there's a line here. And like you've crossed it or we're over it, or in my job, my responsibility is to hold the parameters of the team, which is all, and you're pushing on it and we're not doing that. And the answer is no. Same as parenting, the same kind of vibe.
I was thinking the same, that there's a parallel with parenting. Yeah. And by the way, those leaders, cool, calm, collected. You could tell it was almost like if you were paying attention, calculated.
Oh, yeah. I had dinner with a friend last night and her daughter is like going through some stuff and she was sort of being like, "Oh God." And she's the most composed, thoughtful. She runs this great business person. She's like, kind of lost it like today with my kid. And she's like, "I slammed my door. I was like, I'm not dealing with this anymore." And then she was kind of reflecting back. She's like, "Quite honestly, I wanted to also send the message that
they're crossed
a line and you've like really pissed me off. And there's not a, you know," and I was like, "I totally know that feeling."
And the parent's a human being, right?
Yeah. You're modeling that you heard me. Yeah.
Like you have emotions as a parent. I don't want to end the podcast without talking about neuroticism.
Yeah, talk about the fifth one. go.
It's such a big part. And I know you work on resilience and mindset. I score high in neuroticism. It can be fuel for performance. Mm-hmm. From sports psychology, we learn that optimal performance does not occur at a stress level of zero.
Yeah, yeah. The Yerkes-Dodge curve, right?
Yeah, Yerkes-Dawson curve. Yeah. Stress to a level will increase your performance, especially if you reframe it as activation. After that, it becomes extremely detrimental. Yeah. I don't want people to hear, oh, here's this guy, Sebastian, on a podcast telling me I should be more stressed. I'm already stressed enough. It is a U-shaped curve. But the point is, it's not zero. And some neuroticism will help you prepare, motivate you. I score high. Would love to know how you score. But let me ask a rhetorical question to kind of drive the point. If a surgeon's about to do surgery on you, do you want them to be zero stress?
No, yeah.
Do you want them to be completely chillaxed?
Of course.
Or do you, there's actually a biological function for stress that increases focus.
Yeah.
So you want them to be a little anxious. You want them to overprepare. You want them to triple check the scan. You want them to be focused and concentrated and ultimately in flow. That won't happen if they're just completely chill.
Yeah. For me, so it's again, it's like context dependent. And this friend I was having dinner with, certain things, like I love hosting, love having people over, love cooking. And in my sort of everyday life, I think people would say I'm like kind of, you know, chill or whatever. But there are these parts of my life that are like really high expectation and like over preparedness. One of them is work stuff, like building a company, people's money that I'm responsible for, things like that. I'm like, there's a responsibility that I need to be doing what I need to do to put our company in the best position, right? And there's, so that's just fine. Like I'm, that's what is required of the job. And then the other part of it is my friend came over and we're kind of putting out dinner on the table in sort of a buffet. And she kind of put the meat first versus at the end and had the sides all in a weird order. It's like, whoa. Like, what are you doing here? She's like, God, I've never seen this side of you. And I'm like, no, there's like a way to do this. And this is how it goes. So I would say I come off is more chill, but then there's like parts of me that are just like very black and white. Like this is the way it's done. And also I'll do what I have to do to like make that happen.
For me, it's been a journey to increase my resilience, sports psychology, positive psychology, sleep.
Yeah.
Better diet, exercise, all these things I've worked on to manage my stress better. It's a stressful job.
Yeah.
But resilience is key to an athlete's life.
Mm-hmm.
I had a sports psychologist tell me, do you realize that top athletes are incredibly neurotic?
Yeah.
They're scared of losing. And then think about how high pressure athletic endeavors are. The Olympics, or you train 4 years and you're going to run for 25 minutes and that's it. And you have 3 seconds to make a 3-point shot to save the game, whatever, right?
Mm-hmm.
So to learn to reframe the stress as activation is incredibly powerful. That's one of the things I explore in the psychology of leadership.
Yeah. And in, I used to do a lot more biofeedback I was mentioning, which is like pre Apple Watch. You basically connect people to electrodes and you're looking at, it's arousal is what we would call it in like the health world. And it's like, there's peak arousal at different times. And the other piece of this is like the relaxation part. So we're teaching relaxation. It's like, you can go hard, you can do all the things, but it's really important to then tend to the relaxation part because your system needs time to come back down. And that's, and I'm really diligent about sleeping, eating, exercise. Like I got to get my sleep. I try to at least go for a long walk every day and then eating like eat somewhat decently, at least high quality. I could be better there, but good.
It's amazing how I don't understand why in our society people underestimate these things. We talk about hacks, about cures, about influencers, about medication. Nothing wrong with medication if you need it, but about all these things. And it's just bottom line is you got to get these three. Eat a decent diet, get sleep, and exercise.
Yeah. Sleeping, eating, exercise are a holy trilogy of health. And when you first started talking, you were kind of asking about nature versus nurture and temperament and things. And I was thinking, you know, we're born with a temperament, but the social context, like drive, all these types of things can change how we are like sort of shaped. But in the bio, in the clinical health lens, which I use, I just see the world, it's biopsychosocial. So what's going on with a person biologically? So what are premorbid? What's going on with them in terms of like medical diagnosing things? But things like sleeping, eating, exercise, where are they there?
Yeah.
The psycho part is the coping part. What's your mindset? How do you think about yourself and others? And the social is really the social context in which you're in.
Yeah, I want to say something about rest, because I saw you had an episode on burnout as well. I like to say that Simone Biles became a better gymnast by watching Netflix on Sundays.
Yeah.
I make it counterintuitive on purpose. Mm-hmm. She had the twisties in Tokyo in 2021, mm-hmm. anxiety related, overtraining related. She couldn't find herself in the air. She famously walked out of the Olympics.
Yeah.
And after that, she embarked on a regimen. She was tweeting about watching Netflix or trying to get more sleep. And she came back in 24 and won 3 gold, 1 silver, is the most decorated gymnast of all time. So let's just remember that. Simone Biles became a better gymnast by watching Netflix on Sundays.
Yeah. I mean, it's a good learning and often easier said than done. But seeing it as tying it to performance, I think would be the thing that helps people move the needle. Scheduling it and being like, this is going to help me be better.
Yeah.
I know we could keep talking, Sebastian. But I know we should probably get ready to wrap up. But is there anything on your mind that I didn't ask you about? So first off, where can people get your book and anything that you want to end on?
Thank you. The Psychology of Leadership by Sebastian Page. It's easiest on Amazon, but it's everywhere. I'm also on LinkedIn. That's probably the easiest way to find me. We covered a lot. I really like that we overlap, even though you started as a clinical psychologist and I'm a business person, and we kind of gravitated towards the same concepts. I'm glad we talked about personality today. What I would leave with people that we didn't talk about today on positive psychology, it's a very famous finding. It's probably not as well known as people think, is that the number one factor for happiness in people's lives, according to the Harvard study, is the quality of the relationships in your life. It's not whether you're healthy or sick, rich, in prison, whatever circumstances. It's the quality of the relationships in your life. So that's the one thing I want to say before we leave. Go and hug someone today. Tell them you love them.
Yeah, that's what I'm so focused on, right, is connectedness and cohesion, because we know those makes everything better, from happiness to business performance to longevity, right? But it's like we're social by nature, hardwired for connection. And so strength of relationship really matters. So I love that. Well, I just appreciate you being on, Sebastian. That was a really fun conversation.
Thank you.
And I just look forward to chatting more.
Likewise. Thank you, Bobby.